Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.
From Valley Public Radio in Fresno and Bakersfield, this is Valley Edition, FM89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, we'll learn about a new effort to enhance early childhood education called Talking is Teaching. It's bringing together everyone from the Fresno County District Attorney to local educators and business leaders. We'll learn why they hope to close something called the word gap and what that means for the community as a whole. We'll also explore the past, present, and future of the Bakersfield Sound in a preview of a free event presented by Zocalo Public Square Wednesday night at the Metro Galleries with the Bakersfield Californians' Robert Price. But first, we turn our attention to one of the greatest assets of the Golden State, our state parks. The system has had a rough few years, deep budget cuts during the recession, and a financial scandal that rocked the department. Later this week, a state commission called Parks Forward is set to release a report that demands the department modernize itself. This, of course, is happening at the same time that Governor Jerry Brown's new budget proposes only enough money to buy the park system a year to turn itself around. Capital Public Radio's Ben Adler brings us this special report from Sacramento.
One, two, three!
Barely a cannon shot from the state capitol is Sutter's Fort State Historic Park. For years, it's hosted elementary school students from throughout California. On this day, students from Sacramento's David Lubin Elementary School are visiting. They're taking part in the Environmental Living Program. They and some of their parents spend 24 hours at the fort in costumes from 1846, learning about life as pioneers. Third grader Joseph Cochran has noticed a few differences.
With the pioneers, they didn't have electronics like we do today, like PlayStation, PS2s, and they didn't have football teams or something. And they didn't have fancy clothes like jeans, basketball shoes.
Sutter's Fort never closed during the recession, but it and all 270 state parks have faced their share of cuts. Here's Capital Public Radio's Marianne Russ in October 2009.
They're the kind of changes that parkgoers will notice. Some will be open only a few days a week. There will be fewer open restrooms, trash cans, and open campgrounds. There will also be fewer school tours of historic parks.
The low point for the state park system came in summer 2012. The department's director resigned after reports that the Parks Department had secretly hoarded $20 million at a time when Governor Jerry Brown's administration had slated 70 parks for closure. Brown's Secretary of Natural Resources, John Laird, took up damage control.
This is deeply disappointing because we just went to many partners around the state to get them to step up and cover the shortfall. And I'm truly sorry about that.
2.5 years later, all parks are still open, some thanks to partnerships with nonprofit groups or federal or local agencies. The governor proposes some new money for the park system, for longstanding maintenance and new revenue-generating projects, and he's setting aside some one-time money to continue existing service levels, though as acting parks director Lisa Mongett says.
When we say maintain service, we mean at the current level. So not at where we were 5 years ago, where we were 10 years ago.
Meanwhile, the state commission is just days away from releasing a final report that's expected to call for an outside parks funding partner. And Mongett has responded to the commission's draft report by creating a transformation team to lead the system's overhaul.
We can't keep putting off the heavy lift and taking a really good, hard look at ourselves as a department and reset things. And so that's where we look to the transformation team.
Mongett says the department is looking at adding new camping loops at popular parks and allowing visitors to pay with credit cards or even their cell phones. Bigger changes are likely not too far down the road. Patty Weber, one of the third grade teachers at Sacramento's David Lubin Elementary, whose students are visiting Sutter's Fort, says the park scandal shouldn't have happened and it's time for the state to turn its park system around.
To be accessible to, you know, the highest number of people who would like to be here visiting to any of our parks. If there's a way to lessen bureaucracy and make the places better, then I guess that's what I'm for.
The governor's budget says the one-time money for existing service levels will give the transformation team the time to turn the park system around. The implication is clear. the money won't be available next year. At the State Capitol, I'm Ben Adler.
You're listening to Valley Edition. Here's a sobering thought. According to researchers at Rice University, children from high-income families will experience about 30 million more words by age 4 than children of low-income families. That's parents or others reading or just talking to young children, describing the world around them. Researchers call this the so-called word gap, and it has big implications for brain development, educational achievement, and long-term success in life. Now a national program from a group called Too Small to Fail is taking on this issue, and it's coming here to the Valley with its campaign called Talking is Teaching, Talk, Read, and Sing. Here to tell us more about this program, we have with us in our studio Linda Gleason of the Children's Movement, a local coalition focused on childhood reading. Linda, welcome.
Thank you.
And we also have Kendra Rogers, a familiar name to many of our listeners. She is currently the Director of Community Investment for Granville Homes, which donated the funds for this project, and her boss, Darius Assemi, President of Granville Homes, who made the $100,000 gift in support of this campaign. Thanks to both of you for joining us today.
Thank you. Good morning.
Thank you and good morning.
Linda, I want to start with you, and what are we talking about when we hear this term, the word gap? What does that really mean? It's not vocabulary necessarily at age 4, right?
Right. It's a combination of words and phrases, sentences, and the difference between what low-income children hear by the time they're 3 and children from middle and upper middle-income homes.
And why is it an important concern?
Well, word development is – language development is a critical factor in the overall brain development of children and young children in particular. And it is a predictor of their ability to read on grade level by the time they're in third grade and other indicators along the growth continuum.
And what is your role in this project? How is this going to work? Because you have Too Small to Fail, that's their campaign, and Kendra, feel free to chime in here. You have other coalitions that are involved, NextGen and the Clinton Foundation. This is an initiative that they started and helped. And then you have the Children's Movement and all the other partners. You have Fresno County, you have Fowler Unified, the district attorney. There's a lot of moving parts here. How does this work?
Sure. So this campaign was developed by Too Small to Fail. And so they are a partnership of the Next Generation and the Bill and Hillary and Chelsea Clinton Foundation. And so this so far, their goal is to turn this kind of the world into a literacy-rich environment for young children. And so far, they have launched in Oakland and Tulsa. And so it was because of the work that's been done through the Children's Movement, that kind of table that had been set with all of these different community partners that are already engaged around third grade level reading, that we had the ability to really pull this together very quickly and in a very deep way in our community. And that was why Too Small to Fail said, yes, we want to join you. We want Fresno to be the first county in the Valley. And it was only possible because of Darius's commitment and willingness to allow my time to do this work, but also to really get the fun part off the ground, which are the billboards and the radio spots and the TV ads. And so he can share a little bit about why he made the gift that he did to our kids.
Yeah. Darius, you have Kendra working for you now. This is a little bit, I guess you could say, unusual. Kendra comes to you from First Five of Fresno County, where she ran that program for a number of years. And you have her focusing on this. Why is this an important concern to you as a businessman?
Joe, I think you just heard from Linda and Kendra why this impacts has long-term impacts and ramifications for our community as a whole. We have several ills in our community. One is a lack of job expansion and wage growth. These are some long-term issues that we all need to tackle. To address some of these issues, we need to work with early childhood education. And this is one program that addresses some of these issues in our community, especially within the underprivileged, to help move the ball downfield. And we want to inspire and request our policymakers to get on board with us in the same arena as well.
So, Kendra, you mentioned that you're going to have billboards and things. Exactly what does it mean launching this program? You're trying to reach parents and others who interact mm-hmm. with these children. What does it actually do, this program?
Right. So the point of this is that, you know, 80% of a child's brain develops by age three. So this is about early literacy, but it's also about critical brain development. And so we know in a community that is struggling with resources, despite our need, you know, one in three children are born in poverty in Fresno County, that we can't afford a lot of the expensive programs. So what's beautiful about this campaign and why Darius was so willing to invest is it's free. It's about parents, caregivers, grandparents, neighbors, just using the environment that they're in to engage with children. So the billboards, for example, are giving contextual prompts. It says, let's talk about the sky. Let's talk about the city. So as parents, you know, we're all busy. I'm a working mom with two little kids. I know what I should be doing, but trying to do it is hard. So this is meant to give them those reminders. Let's talk about food. What shape is that? What color is that? To give them the language that they need and to just remind all of us when we see those billboards or we hear those spots to engage with our littlest ones.
And Linda, Kendra mentioned something I think that's important. You're talking about especially targeting folks from lower income households who have a lot of other challenges. A lot of these folks are single parents. They're working. They aren't at home. They don't have the time necessarily. There's so many pressures. They're working two jobs. Is this as much of a problem of that as it is the awareness of knowing that this is a good thing to do? How do you overcome that? And what is the strategy there?
Well, I think this campaign is a lot about awareness. And I do think that that's a huge contributor to why it is an issue. I think even in regardless of income level, a lot of us, I think that this has been a big aha moment. I think this research and its connection to brain development and literacy development down the continuum again as these children get older has been a wake-up call. And it's something that many people can get connected to. The beauty of this campaign is that it has the reach that it does. Kendra mentioned the mass marketing aspect of the campaign. It also will have tentacles into the healthcare arena, new baby bags, pediatricians writing prescriptions to make sure that mothers are know that they should be talking, reading, and singing to their children. The Asimi Granville Foundation has been a huge example of how private industry can step up. There are many different ways. So the ability for this entire community to contribute to helping to solve this issue is huge, and this campaign is really a great platform for that.
Is there a concern at all, maybe not so much with this program in particular, this by its general nature, is there a concern, though, about duplication of services? There's so many organizations out there that are all trying to do their part and mm-hmm. all have great focus and efforts to raise the bar in early childhood education. Of course, you have First Five. You have a lot of nonprofits. You have the Children's Movement. You have Read Fresno. You have all these other mm-hmm. reading programs. You have this now. Is that a concern? Because I've heard that mentioned a lot about the Central Valley, that you have a lot of organizations that are doing good work, but maybe it's spread too thin because they have their own overheads and they have to deal with these things. Kendra, what do you see? Because you're coming from First Five.
Right. Well,
they had an initiative statewide about this, right?
Correct. And actually, when I was at First Five, we kind of gave birth to the children's movement, and that was the very reason. As we said, you know, we have all these organizations doing all of this work, but we don't have a venue for them to come together to talk, to really learn together and understand the issues. And so what was exciting about this campaign was first and foremost to have a business leader like Granville committing their time and stepping up in a big way to support it. But it was also the fact that you had organizations already there. They're looking at literacy and they didn't say, well, let's try to get funding to run an expensive literacy program. They said, let's tap into what's already there and let's start with babies. So you had even school age, you know, educators saying, no, we get that it starts with babies. And then you have folks like Darius, who through his philanthropy is really kind of raising the bar and also requiring that organizations partner together, that the organizations he's investing in are collaborating, that there's not a duplication. So I definitely think it's something that we're really mindful of.
How do you define success with a program like this? What's the end game here? What is success? And I don't know if that's Linda or Darius.
Yeah.
Lower unemployment, mm-hmm. higher prosperity, higher wage growth, healthier, more vibrant community, less gang warfare, less criminal activity.
Those are long-term goals.
And you have to start at age zero, basically.
And Linda, your thoughts on that when it comes to not just this program, but it is such a long-term approach. When do we start to see those results? And are we seeing anything? Because this is not the beginning of the overall effort in the macro sense in dealing with these issues. People have been talking about this in the Valley now and early childhood education for a long time, but especially in the last 10 years. Do you think we're starting to see any indicators that we might be on the right track? Is the line moving in the right direction in any way, especially early on?
Well, I think, and speaking from this perspective with regard to the children's movement and its birth only 3 years ago, the focus has really been about building a coalition, as Kendra mentioned, of organizations and institutions and parents, residents that are focused on a couple of key benchmarks for our kids. I think while First Five up and down the state has done a tremendous job of raising the awareness of the importance of early investment, locally here, I think that the early success has been in the growing awareness and urgency around getting our decision makers, business, policymakers, institutional leaders to really be willing to make an investment early on. I think we've been a community that's so used to responding to criminal activity, to the unemployment issues at the later, when these kids are at a point where it's more difficult, more challenging. And so this has really been about a community galvanizing around the importance of tackling this stuff upstream.
Yes, go ahead, Doris.
We can invest in early childhood education or invest in incarcerating people down the road.
Yeah, Kendra, how do you reach this population? Is that one of the challenges that you face with implementing something like this?
Yes, it can be. However, because of the partners, you know, we have Housing Authority on board. So when you talk about where some of our lowest income families live, you know, they're going to have these posters up in their all throughout their developments, their lobbies running PSAs. We have the libraries. They'll be doing talk reading workshops and, you know, reinforcing through the prompts within the library system, WIC, Head Start. So, you know, we have a lot of partners that see this as something to just kind of enhance and liven up and kind of make more fun the messages they were already trying to send out. So I think it's really about galvanizing the community and, as Darius has stated, really getting the business community behind this type of work and understanding that if they want to turn this economy around, it's got to be a long-term strategy and it's got to start upstream.
How is this working in other communities? You mentioned that it was in Tulsa and I forget the other city.
And Oakland.
Are we seeing any success stories coming out of that, or what are we learning from that?
Yeah, they're seeing the buzz. They're hearing parents talk about it. They're hearing grandparents, you know, talking and reading newspapers to their kids, you know, their grandkids that they have, things that they weren't doing before. Again, because it's the little simple, these are simple tidbits, but it's just reminding us to slow down as a community, you know, put down our phones, turn off the radio in the cars or at the bus, and just really sit there and engage and talk with the little ones in our lives.
Again, if you just joined us today, we're talking about this new program called Talking is Teaching, Talk, Read, Sing. It is a national effort from two groups, Next Gen and the Bill and Hillary and Chelsea Clinton Foundation. And it's partnering in Fresno with a number of groups, including the Children's Movement and others, to bring this program to Fresno. And we have with us today in the studio Linda Gleason of the Children's Movement, as well as the folks who are putting up the funding to make this happen in the Valley. And that's Darius Sasemi of Granville Homes and his director of community investment, Kendra Rogers, who comes to the company from First Five, where she used to run First Five Fresno County. What else? Let's go back to this idea of the word gap, Linda. How big of a concern is this? And it's not just something that stops at age four. We're looking at it at age four, age five, but the ramifications down the road continue. What do you think about that?
Well, it's a critical benchmark. I think that the indicator that we're paying very close attention to throughout the county is the percentage of our children that are reading on grade level by third grade. That's a critical benchmark because children shift when they go into fourth grade from learning how to read to reading to learn. And we have only 45% of our kids reading on grade level by third grade across the county. Those children are six times more likely to drop out of high school. There is research and indicators that the literacy rate is used to identify the need for prison beds down the road. It's a critical benchmark for our kids, and this the word gap and literacy and language development is a huge precursor to whether or not they'll be able to meet that benchmark.
And Kendra, are there any places where we're seeing, not necessarily just with this program because there's only three communities now that are doing this, but are there any success stories out there where we've seen concerted efforts that have made a difference nationally or wherever along these lines? Is this something we can actually have success with?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, what's really disheartening, though, is that where we're seeing a lot of this play out is in other countries. You know, we have other countries that have taken the United States research around early childhood, the research from James Heckman, who's a Nobel Prize winning economist, who has proven from an economic standpoint best return on investment is early learning and early childhood. And you're seeing this where communities have kind of gone all in and gone deep in terms of early investment. You are seeing tremendous shifts in their outcomes for kids. They are eliminating the disparity gap. So really, it depends. We're going to get out of it what we put into it. And so as long as we continue to kind of trickle little things here and there, we're going to see limited effort. But if we're willing to kind of go all in as a community, which when you have a third of your children in poverty, you know, it's going to take a big lift to get this out and get this turned around. I'm proud to be at Granville and be part of a corporation that understands that a thriving community starts at birth.
Yeah, Darius, Kendra mentioned return on investment as a businessman. It's something that you're familiar with. You support a lot of organizations in the community, including this station. I want to ask you, the last year you told the Fresno Bee that you believe the best philanthropy is good public policy. And that happened to come in a story the Bee was doing about the political side and political donations. You indicated you're going to be more active in supporting candidates that you believe will advance causes in the community. I know that many people listening to us right now are excited to hear about your participation here. I know, however, there's also some who are maybe a little skeptical, not just of corporations of, such as Granville investing in campaigns, but corporations in general involved in that area. How do you feel about that? And is, in your view, what is good for Granville good for the community? Or how do you separate those two sides from philanthropy to the business side? Because they both play a part.
So what's good for the community would be good for business, for all businesses. So part of our drive is to the health and well-being of this community is very important to us. So we need to address the issues at all levels, directly helping organizations that address immediate needs for instant gratification, whether it's, you know, we have many incredible organizations here, such as Food Bank and Poverella House. So we have immediate needs that need to be addressed. And then the longer needs, longer-term issues, which is early childhood education and preventing unwanted teen pregnancy, some of the areas that we're going to be addressing and focusing our resources in. And along with that, we want to make sure we have policymakers that understand these challenges that we face in our community. And we want to be working alongside with them, giving them the information, providing the data and the resources, and our company is very dedicated to doing the research and providing our policymakers and getting a team of policymakers that understand the issues, that can understand long-term issues and how to address the long-term challenges of our community. So along those lines, yes, we are involved in campaigns because, again, the best philanthropy is good public policy, and we want to make sure our policymakers understand the issues. So we want to support those policymakers.
And if I could add on that, you know, when I was at First Five, after, you know, 15 years and almost, you know, close to pushing almost $200 million invested in the community, our poverty rates were higher than when we started for our kids. And I realized that we cannot serve our way out of poverty. And so we had started getting far more active in public policy work and looking at the real issues that were creating the conditions that our kids stayed in this place. So it's been really interesting kind of being on this side of things and hearing some of the criticisms. And, you know, I was sharing with Darius, I said, you know, because I'm the person that processes a lot of it, people have no problems asking him for resources and money for, you know, the work they're doing, the services, their organizations. But, you know, because he's realized that the policy issues are really at the root, the investment in candidates, then kind of they people raise an eye. And so I can assure you that what we're doing and the policies that and the candidates that he's, you know, would be supporting in the future are those that care about our kids, that care about their well-being, that understand the complexity of these issues. And I'm really proud that he's willing to put as much into the politics side in making sure that these programs have the policy support they need as the philanthropy.
We have about 20 seconds, Darius.
And we want to inspire and ask every citizen of this community to get involved in policymaking.
Great. Again, we've been talking with Darius Assemi, president of Granville Homes, and Kendra Rogers, director of community investment for Granville. Granville recently made this gift in support of the new program from Too Small to Fail called Talking is Teaching, Talk, Read, Sing. Linda Gleason with the Children's Movement, who's helping to implement it, also with us today. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment with more on Valley Edition. You're listening to Valley Edition. The competitive struggle between two local hospitals over the future of pediatric care reached a new level Monday. FM89's Deanna Aguilera reports on an expanded partnership between one hospital and a Bay Area institution.
Community medical centers and UCSF plan to strengthen their partnership in the Valley by expanding pediatric specialty care and a pediatric medical education program at CMC's downtown Fresno Hospital. The center's announcement came weeks after rival Valley Children's Hospital revealed a plan to build its own pediatric residency and fellowship programs after working with UCSF for years. Craig Wagner is the CEO of Community Regional Medical Center. He says expanding pediatric care is a priority.
This is really part of our longer-term strategy to provide health care to the entire family.
But Wagner also says the move is in response to recent actions by Valley Children's, which has announced it is expanding its partnership with Stanford.
When Children's went in the direction that they went into and decided to cancel their contract with Asante IPA, and then also to cancel their agreement with UCSF, we needed to kind of step in and help support UCSF, but also we needed that piece to complete our strategy.
Tensions between the two hospitals escalated last year when Valley Children's chose to shut out referrals from Sante, a physicians group affiliated with Community.
You know, there's thousands of children affected by Children's decision to get out of their Sante IPA agreement. So that's why that's more of an immediate short-term goal to make sure that we have the pediatric subspecialists necessary to meet the needs of those kids.
Wagner says their short-term goal is to have more specialists at CRMC by this summer. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Diana Aguilera.
You're listening to Valley Edition. California lawmakers say public opinion has changed since the last time Right to Die legislation has been proposed in the state. That may explain why a group of Democratic lawmakers has introduced the End of Life Option Act. As Capital Public Radio's healthcare reporter Pauline Bartolone explains, the measure is modeled after a similar law in Oregon.
Jennifer Glass of San Mateo was diagnosed with lung cancer 2 years ago. She was in her late 40s and learned she had a slim chance of surviving the next 5 years. She had just gotten married and was starting a family with her husband and stepchildren.
From the first days of the diagnosis, our focus was on getting all the information we could at every phase and having as many options as we could at every phase. That meant options for treatment. That meant options for care. That meant options for end of life.
She now takes an oral chemotherapy pill every day. And for now, her cancer is contained.
I don't know how long I have. I do know that the time I have, I could live more joyfully and live more fully if I knew that I'd have options if cancer runs its course.
Glass says she would fear the end of life less if she had more choice about how she died. So she's advocating for the right to obtain a prescription from a doctor that would ease and speed the dying process. That's not legal in California. So Glass, along with lawmakers like Democratic Senator Bill Monning, are pushing for a law that would give her that choice.
The core of this is respecting the dignity and the self-determination, and I believe a civil right and a human right of a patient with a terminal diagnosis who faces a death sentence not of their own choosing.
The California bill would allow patients who are told they have less than 6 months left to live and are of sound mind to self-administer a physician's prescription to speed death. The request to a physician would have to be made several times, verbally and in writing. It would need witnesses and more than one physician involved. Manning says the measure would ease the experience of dying for everyone.
A peaceful passing with compassion, both for patient and for suffering family members.
Similar proposals have been brought before California lawmakers many times over the last 20 years. They've failed, but proponents say now other states are introducing similar legislation. And Manning says the time is right for California.
I think there's been a sea change in public awareness. I think we have a medical system that's evolving to respect and recognize more patient-centered decision-making, patient right to know what their options are.
But Tim Rosales of Californians Against Assisted Suicide believes lawmakers should be very careful not to make policy that could affect millions of people based on the decisions of individual patients.
Certainly many more states have opposed assisted suicide than support assisted suicide, and I don't expect that to change, and we're prepared to vigorously fight against it.
Rosales says doctors, disability rights advocates, and religious groups oppose prescriptions that are meant to kill, not heal. He says if death-aiding medications are available, patients might choose them because they're cheaper than life-saving treatments. Rosales claims the Oregon law shows people have other reasons for taking life-ending drugs.
They're choosing this because they say they fear being a burden or they fear of losing control. It's not suffering and it's not pain.
Jennifer Glass has another reason for wanting an end-of-life option law in California. When she does die, she says, she wants to be at home with her family.
I would find great comfort in knowing that I had another option, that I might choose to be done with cancer before cancer is done with me.
In Sacramento, I'm Pauline Bartolone.
You're listening to Valley Edition. Struggling sugar beet farmers in the San Joaquin Valley are turning their crop into energy instead of sweetener. A pilot plant could prove to be good for the environment and the economy. Leslie McClurg reports.
They're called energy beets. They look like a red table beet, but they're larger, white, and very high in sucrose. Sugar beets in California date back to the late 1800s.
Beets have been grown here commercially longer than any other place.
Steve Kafka is the director of the California Biomass Collaborative. He says yields in the state are the best in the world. But the price of sugar has dropped so far that sugar beets are no longer a viable crop. But Kafka says energy beets could keep farmers in business.
You can make anything from sugar, and you need very little sophisticated technology to do it. So basically, you're starting with a very high-quality feedstock input material.
A cooperative of sugar beet farmers just opened a demonstration biorefinery south of Fresno. Jim Tischer is the project manager. He says Mendota Bioenergy LLC will bring jobs to a struggling rural area.
The small town that we're looking at has, you know, as high as 40 to 45% unemployment in the winter.
If the testing plant is successful, a commercial-scale biorefinery will be built in the next 2 to 3 years. The facility is expected to produce about 15 million gallons of ethanol annually. But Steve Kafka says beet growers will face the same problem as other farmers in California.
The large question that overhangs agriculture in general in the state right now is water policy.
In other words, should water during a drought be used to grow a crop that can't be eaten? In Sacramento, I'm Leslie McClurg.
You're listening to Valley Edition. The world's faith in democratic ideals has been shaken by recent events in Paris and other locations throughout the world. A commitment to democratic ideals and precautionary measures were simultaneously debated. In this edition of FM 89's commentary series, The Moral Is, Fresno State Education Professor Jack Benega argues that short-term constrictive reactions, though perhaps necessary, won't be as effective as long-term solutions that reinforce democratic values.
Horrifying events. That's how a CNN correspondent characterized the recent murders in Paris, where Charlie Hebdo cartoonist, Jews shopping at a kosher grocery store, and several police were murdered by sleeper cells supported by Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State. Simultaneously, but receiving considerably less coverage, Boko Haram, a Nigerian Islamist terrorist group, massacred as many as 2,000 people, mostly women, children, and the elderly. The bad news continued, with that same group sending out little children as suicide bombers, girls as young as 10 years old. These shocking events have stunned us, as have the Taliban murder in Pakistan of 132 children and the beheadings of Western journalists by the Islamic State. In the wake of such events, the U.S. State Department issued a travel alert, warning about the continued threat of terrorist attacks and other violent actions against the U.S. citizens and interests overseas. How different is the reaction in the United States to violations of public sensitivities? I remember the exhibit in 1987 by photographer Andre Serrano of a crucifix submerged in a bottle of the artist's own urine and aptly titled Piss Christ. This piece of controversial art was prominently displayed in galleries, and the artist received funding from our own National Endowment for the Arts. Although this work was widely criticized, it continues to be shown, but the controversy has subsided. Free speech, even though distasteful, is tolerated in democracies. Clearly, our country and those affected in Europe are stepping up security precautions in the wake of overseas events. We need to do this. But this is a short-term solution. We can't militarize ourselves out of this problem. A long-term solution is also warranted, and that solution must involve the education of our children. John Dewey wrote almost 100 years ago that the purpose of education, in all places that offer it, is to lead youth to develop in an orderly, sequential way to societal membership. In a democracy, that's an aspiration to live morally, creatively, and productively. Accordingly, our public school system has historically assumed the responsibility to teach children about the rights of a free people, including the rights of free speech, free expression, and dissent. But in an age of accountability and testing, are we losing sight of this fundamental obligation to our children and the future of our democracy? Today's American schools overwhelmingly are focused on college and career readiness skills to the diminution of our foundational values. Neglecting civic values in our schools communicates the message that civic values are less important. The recent crises in Europe would argue that we must do more. An influential report, The Civic Mission of Schools, identifies 6 instructional approaches that assist students to be engaged in their communities and committed to the public good. These practices include formal instruction in government, history, law, and democracy, as well as opportunities to apply those concepts and connecting that content with real-world action projects. Such efforts deserve more support. It is feared the recent events in France and actions in other countries that ignore fundamental basic rights will ripple to our shores. We must be vigilant in the short term and the long term, always with an eye to the perpetuation of the basic ideals that made our country great. For The Moral Is, this is Jacques Benninga.
The Moral Is a production of the Bonner Center for Character Education at Fresno State and Valley Public Radio. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of the station or the center. You can find more commentaries on our website at kvpr.org. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Detroit has Motown, Seattle has grunge, and San Francisco has psychedelic rock. Just 3 examples of American cities where unique musical styles developed and thrived, gaining international attention and helping to define the very image of those places. Here in the San Joaquin Valley, you can add another city to that list, Bakersfield.
It was here in the 1950s and 60s that young musicians, children of the Dust Bowl migration to California, began to develop their own brand of country music. It was loud, rough, and rowdy music born in small clubs with names like the Blackboard and Trouts. They played for oil field roughnecks, farm laborers, and blue-collar workers of all stripes. Their music spurned the lush pop-influenced country politan sound that dominated Nashville at the time, with the signature twang of pedal steel guitar and the bright cutting sound of the solid body Telecaster. The sound swept the nation, making Bakersfield Nashville West for a time and making Buck Owens and Merle Haggard international stars. Even the Beatles got into the act, covering Owens' Act Naturally. But as tastes change, so do communities. The heyday of the Bakersfield sound was decades ago. Owens died in 2006, while Haggard, who is now 77, continues to tour and record. So where does the Bakersfield sound stand today? And what does Bakersfield sound like in 2015? That's the topic of a free event presented by our partner Zocalo Public Square at the Metro Galleries in downtown Bakersfield this Wednesday night. Robert Price, editor of the Bakersfield Californian, will moderate the event. He's also the author of the upcoming book, The Bakersfield Sound: How a Generation of Displaced Okies Revolutionized American Music. He joins us now on Valley Edition. Robert, welcome.
Good morning.
Robert, we talk about the Bakersfield sound like it's one thing, this monolithic entity, but there's really a big stylistic difference between the two titans of the music, Buck and Merle, say between I've Got a Tiger by the Tail and Mama Tried, not to mention the other practitioners of the music. Do we need to expand our idea of what it means when we say the Bakersfield sound, and what does it mean to you?
I hear that question all the time, you know, what is the Bakersfield sound? And you're right, Buck Owens sounds very much different than Merle Haggard and many of the others. You know, Merle Haggard has sort of a jazz sensibility about a lot of his music, and whereas Buck kind of has that that driving rockabilly-influenced sound. You know, I've said that if Buck Owens had hit it big in 1966 instead of 1961, he might have been on playlists alongside, you know, the Eagles and Creedence Clearwater Revival and Poco and a lot of those bands. He was very much a part of that scene, a precursor to that scene. So, you know, why do we include, you know, Jazzy Merle and Rockabilly Buck in the same, you know, under the same umbrella of the Bakersfield sound? It's clearly not a lot of similarities between their sounds. And I think the conclusion I've reached is that the Bakersfield sound is really a time and a place and a phenomenon that you know, kind of hit this town, you know, just serendipitously. The sounds themselves are not that close.
Why Bakersfield and why at that time? Of course, Bakersfield received so many immigrants from the Dust Bowl in Kern County, but it wasn't the only place that had that same population coming to the West Coast. They went to Los Angeles. They went further up north, all the way to Sacramento and even beyond. Why Bakersfield?
Yeah, the Dust Bowl migrants went all the way up to into Seattle, all the way down into San Diego. I mean, they really fully moved to the West Coast. Kern County, however, did have the biggest concentration of Dust Bowl migrants. James Gregory, the University of Washington sociologist, I guess he is, historian sociologist, studied where they all went, and the population of Kern County during one period of the late 30s, early 40s, increased 69% attributable to the Dust Bowl migration. So you did have a lot of people here. You had people with musical talent come here. You also had a built-in audience of blue-collar types, field workers and oil field workers. But that was just part of it. I've come to realize that World War II was probably as big a factor in creating the music scene here. You had large migrations of people coming to Southern California to work in the aircraft factories, you know, the Santa Monica area. You had people like Spade Cooley entertaining them, and then you had a lot of people going to Northern California to the places like the city of Richmond. Bob Wills was up there, and a lot of Western swing artists were up in Northern California, and they had a huge built-in audiences there. Of course, the young aircraft factory and and shipyard factory workers. After the war, you know, what did these people do? A lot of them went back to their homes. A lot of them liked the West Coast, and so they stayed. And there were some interesting sort of Pied Piper-type people that were out of Bakersfield that brought musicians down here. I'm thinking of Bill Woods, who had worked up in Northern California. I'm thinking of Ferland Husky, who had come to the West Coast. Cousin Herb Henson, who had come out from Illinois and stayed and talked up the city. You know, whenever they went out of town, they said, hey, you know, you want to come on down to Bakersfield because there's something really happening here, because there was. And so in those post-war years, that's when things really kind of took shape here.
Now, as Buck and Merle became international stars, the Bakersfield scene continued. Many of those people you talked about, Bill Woods, Red Simpson, and others who were still in town, still playing the small clubs, not the big concert halls, they kept the music going. What was that scene like off the sort of the A-list name level of superstardom, but Bakersfield's club scene in those days?
You know, another factor in the creation of the Bakersfield Sound was, and is, and you know, was Bakersfield's relative isolation. It's 2 hours from any place, and back in the 30s and 40s and 50s, cars weren't very reliable, not nearly as reliable as they were. So Bakersfield was sort of became this oasis, a family trip or a, you know, whatever it might be, a business trip. You're tired after several hours in the car, and here's this glittery neon oasis that was Union Avenue. And so there were a lot of clubs here, not just country and western clubs, but jazz clubs and fancy restaurants and so forth. So there was an energy here that was created largely by the fact that here's this place that you have to drive a long way to get to, and it's going to be a long way to drive out of as well. Springing up around Union Avenue primarily were these smaller clubs, usually smaller clubs that catered to the blue collar types. It's sort of a symbiotic relationship that spanned all the different cultures and socioeconomics of the area. And it was, you know, this back before, you know, Mothers Against Drunk Driving, it was not uncommon, sad to say, to, you know, get in the car and drive from the Blackboard all the way across town to Edison Highway, where you had the Lucky Spot and the Clover Club. There was just a dynamic, an energy there, sort of a pre-television era that just sort of spawned all this stuff.
When did things start to change?
Well, I mentioned, you know, Mothers Against Drunk Driving. There was a sort of awareness at some point that, you know, we can't keep doing this. This is dangerous stuff. We have to kind of reel it in. That was one factor. Then, as I mentioned, you know, also television, people just stopped going out so much. They started, you know, just staying home and watching Father Knows Best and Your Show of Shows and I Love Lucy. And very gradually, that cultural imperative or whatever just sort of changed a little bit, and people just started staying home. And I think also the big stars in Bakersfield, Buck and Merle, were not playing in the clubs here so much. They were out on the road. They were stars. And the rest of them just sort of aged out, I guess.
Is there a disappointment there that there was not that next star, that next superstar that came out of the Bakersfield scene? Of course, there was the revival in the 1980s when Dwight Yoakam brought that music again to the top of the country music charts, and of course had that famous record with Buck and the remake of The Streets of Bakersfield. But was there a disappointment there that it didn't continue beyond Buck and Merle at the largest level?
You know, I don't know. That's hard to say. As popular as this music was, this folk rock country rockabilly thing, whatever it was, as popular as it was, it also was, I think there were a lot of people who kind of looked at it as something that they weren't necessarily proud of. It was sort of, you know, there were people here that wanted Bakersfield to be you know, sort of more cosmopolitan, and this country music image was sort of pulling it down a little bit. So I don't know if there was a lot of love lost, you know, at that time, and I guess we're talking about the late 60s, early 70s, into the mid 70s, when things sort of started changing. So not a lot of love lost. It took a long time, I believe, for the city fathers, or, you know, whatever you want to call them, it took a long time for them to realize, hey, you know, that was a special thing that we had here, and we didn't appreciate it, possibly didn't appreciate it to the extent we should have. And I think in the last few years, we've started to see this realization that, you know, this is something we should celebrate and not be, you know, embarrassed by.
As the community
has changed. So has the music itself. How would you characterize, as the topic of this event that's coming up Wednesday night, what does Bakersfield sound like today? What is the current state of Bakersfield sound, and what does the community sound like today? As populations have changed, the children of the Dust Bowl are now, there's increasingly fewer and fewer of them around.
Yeah, you know, I've always said that the Bakersfield sound didn't die, just up and move to Austin, Texas. You know, the best, as Marty Stewart told me one time, the best music, the most inventive, exciting music always comes up away from the big centers, the big cultural centers. Not so much in Nashville, not so much in Los Angeles, not so much in New York, but in places like Bakersfield and, you know, Tupelo, Mississippi, and you know, East St. Louis, Missouri. It comes out of unusual places, and that's still very much the case. But so, what are we left here with in Bakersfield? You know, I think we've sort of been cableized, we've sort of been CNNized, where there's a homogenization that's taken place, where there's not as much difference in cultures between, you know, Boston and Bakersfield. I mean, there's a lot of similarities just brought upon by mass media. So as a result, I think there's a lot of the same things are going on here that are going on in other cities. Whatever you hear on the radio, whatever's popular is being played in the clubs here. There are little visions of the Bakersfield sound popping up here and there. Monty Byram has been around for many years here in Bakersfield, and he's got an exciting sort of a Memphis type sensibility to his music. I don't know if it's even country music, although he certainly plays some of it. There, we've got some pretty good bands around town that are kind of, you know, carrying the flag forward.
One thing that has always struck my ear is, I mentioned the Dwight Yoakam, Buck Owens recording of Streets of Bakersfield. This was done in 1988 or thereabouts, and shot up to the top of the charts. A remake of Buck's earlier recording of that song. But in Dwight's version, he adds the accordion of Flaco Jimenez. I want to play that for our listeners now.
I couldn't find anywhere else. Hey, I'm not trying to be nobody. I just want a chance to be myself. I've spent 1,000 miles of coming.
What do you think about that? That's a fascinating addition to this record, and it works so well. Does it also represent in some way the changing nature of the community?
You know, I think it was great that they added that accordion, and it was appropriate, too, because I think it's been little discussed. The Latino flavors have always been a part of the Bakersfield sound. You know, Bill Woods grew up, you know, playing guitar, you know, with some, you know, Mexican field workers back in the 30s around the campfire. And Buck Owens, I think, has always appreciated that aspect of the music. And so I think it was totally appropriate. You know, in changing California, though, it takes on almost a different sort of meaning. But it's always been an influence.
Again, we're talking with Robert Price. He's the editor of the Bakersfield Californian, and he's moderating an event Wednesday night at the Metro Galleries in downtown Bakersfield about the future of the Bakersfield sound. It's presented by Zocalo Public Square. Who else is on the panel?
We've also got Jim Shaw, who for many, many years was Buck Owens' right-hand man, still works at Buck Owens Productions, and he's a keyboardist for the Buckaroos. Great guy, very knowledgeable. We've also got Jennifer Keel, who comes from a musical family, and she's also sung with the Buckaroos over the years, great vocalist. And Matt Munoz, who is the leader, the front man of Mentu Burro, and he's been a columnist with the Californian for years as well.
Another great event that we're looking forward to, again, taking place this Wednesday night. It's a free event. You can find more information online at Zocalo Public Square. What does Bakersfield sound like today? That's coming up. Robert Price, he's the moderator of the event. Robert, thank you so much for joining us today.
Sure thing. Thanks, Joe.
Well, that does it for this edition of Valley Edition. You can find us online at kvpr.org. You can also send us a tweet at kvpr and at Valley Edition. We'd love to hear from you. For Valley Edition producer Ezra David Romero, reporter Deanna Aguilera, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. You're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.